From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly update of news and events from Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Well, I think the first thing we can talk about, if briefly, because we're still waiting on the actual source materials, but CNN reported that former president of Ecuador, President Correa, made certain statements about Julian Assange and his time at the Ecuadorian embassy. President Correa was the one who allowed Assange asylum in the embassy when during he was still president. And some of the statements that were attributed to President Correa that were reported by CNN included that that basically Assange was meddling because he was providing truthful information, but just about Hillary Clinton and not about Trump. And he also supposedly said, "I'm way closer to Hillary Clinton than Trump. I know her. I admire her. And I was a student in the U.S. doing my doctorate when Bill Clinton was president. Trump is an enemy of our migrants. Why would we support him? None of this makes sense." That's pretty much a quote from CNN's characterization of Correa. So apparently he's walked a lot of this back, and no one has yet produced any kind of a record of any conversation, if such a conversation even took place yet.
Well,
but
yeah,
that caught me off guard.
I'm sorry, Don. What I find extraordinary is that when you read the reports in other media, for example, RT or Sputnik, you just there is no source for that interview.
Right.
And so if CNN doesn't put up a source for it, we have to assume that they're just either downright lying or manipulating old material.
Right.
Because what Correa says, insofar as I've been able to track down, you know, I've been trying to find out what on earth was said by him.
Right.
And the key thing to understand about, there are two things to understand about Rafael Correa in relation to Julian Assange. The first is that Rafael Correa is one of the staunchest defenders of Assange.
Right.
And that's why
in the world, he's the guy that gave him asylum. Assange would have been in prison 6 years ago or whatever.
He's right up there among the strongest, staunchest defenders of Julian Assange.
He's the one that stepped up.
Right.
Yeah.
And in the current situation, whatever you think about Julian Assange, his personal situation is absolutely unforgivable. And the cruelty with which he's been treated and the way his fundamental human rights have been abused deserves outright condemnation, just full stop. And Correa has been one of the people who's also sustained that very clear position in defense of Julian Assange's basic rights.
Yep.
But the other thing to understand about Correa is that he's somebody who means what he says when he talks about the defense of the basic UN principles of non-interference and national sovereignty.
Yep, absolutely.
So and he says that applies to everybody.
Right.
And so what he says is in what the comments that I've been able to track down by him so far is that during the election campaign in the United States between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, he felt that Julian Assange by publishing in WikiLeaks material that was much more damaging to Hillary Clinton than any material that he published with regard to Donald Trump. I have no idea whether that's true or not, but this is apparently what he's saying.
Right, that's what he's saying.
He felt that in that sense, Julian Assange was intervening in the U.S. election, and that would have been fine if he had not been a guest of the U.S. of the Ecuadorian embassy.
Right.
Because he was a guest of the Ecuadorian embassy, it was extremely prejudicial to the government of Ecuador to be in a position where they might legitimately be accused of allowing somebody to unfairly influence or influence an election in a very partial way without giving both sides of whatever story there was to tell at the time. And for that reason, at that time, back in 2016, the embassy denied Julian Assange use of the internet for a period of about two weeks, almost 3 weeks, between right. October the 17th and November the 8th,
right.
during the period of the U.S. election.
Right.
But that was not because they thought that Julian Assange was working for the Russians, which is just ridiculous.
Right, right.
And the Ecuadorian authorities at the time, going by what Correa seems to have said at that time,
yeah.
would just felt embarrassed because the way that Julian Assange was publishing information about that would influence people in the U.S. election campaign,
right.
Made it difficult for the Ecuadorian government to be able to claim complete impartiality right. and respect for national sovereignty of the United States.
Right. It certainly implicates Ecuador as an enabler. I agree with that logic completely, and I understand. By the way, you know, when you offer someone asylum, it's by no means a blank check for people to operate and to say, you know, create their own foreign policy from inside your embassy, etc. I understand all of that,
you and I are going to agree with we're going to agree with Julian Assange, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But the fundamental principle has to be recognized that. Right. He was compromising the position of the Ecuadorian government at
right.
that time.
That's right. And if that's the position that President Correa was taking with CNN, I completely and totally understand it. The way CNN presented it.
I'm sorry. Just quickly. Another thing that he's alleged to have said is that it's certainly true that the material that Julian Assange was publishing about Hillary Clinton was true.
Right.
But there was equally damaging material to be presented about Donald Trump, but he didn't.
But wait a minute. you have 9 million news outlets that were publishing exactly that damaging material about Trump. 24/7, you know. I mean, look, President Correa is right about that. This is our embassy. This is our government. We create our foreign policy. If you're going to be an actor on the global stage, you know, you go rent some headquarters someplace and be an independent actor. Otherwise, if you're going to practice foreign policy from our embassy, it's going to be the one we place in your hands on a piece of paper, like every other ambassador gets, because that policy is made in Quito. I understand that entirely. What I'm talking about is, first, that criticism that it was on balance or not on balance, intrinsically, you know, if you have to look at the context of the election, the entire media, from Fox, including Fox, to Democracy Now! And NPR and all of that, were in the bag for Clinton from 3-4 months before the primaries were over. And so one media outlet is in the bag for Trump, if that's true. You know, I'm sorry, I don't see a problem with that. The other thing, though, more importantly, what gets me is that CNN is representing that President Correa made these other statements about the Clintons, that I'm an admirer of Hillary Clinton. And I was an admirer of President Clinton while I was a graduate student in the United States. Now, you know, before, we've been all head-scratching, like, how in the hell did he throw his arms around this neoliberal knucklehead that ended up succeeding him as, you know, a designated successor, more or less, because he did. And then, you know, did we get duped or fooled? Well, you know, if actually he's an admirer of the Clintons, no. He installed, in other words, is this a suggestion that, in fact, he installed Lenin Moreno, no matter what he says about him now, as a political rival, you know, with forethought and cognition?
Well, who knows?
Right.
I certainly don't know.
And that's why I'm saying we can't rely on CNN.
With Rafael Correa. He's in Belgium.
When I responded to this stuff, I got asked about this morning from Sputnik, and when I responded, I said at the very beginning, first of all, I distrust anything that comes to me through CNN. Simply put, much of their content contains outright lies and or misrepresentations and or mischaracterizations of fact. So I am unsure of any claimed facts, in quotes, that comes through that source without seeing the primary materials and a chain of custody.
Yeah, I don't think that we will.
Of course not.
And because I just find those comments that CNN attributes to Rafael Correa just so far from everything else that I've ever read of by Rafael Correa. It just doesn't add up.
No, this is the same guy when I think it was Obama was talking about let us reinstall our Southcom base in Ecuador, said, yeah, no problem, as soon as we can open a military base in Florida.
Right. So, anyway, let's see. You and I both know that almost anything is possible.
Who knows, yeah.
But I find that extremely hard to credit. And as you say, CNN is totally untrustworthy.
Right.
But I just thought it was interesting that story should crop up because Correa, like the other leaders of the ALBA countries, Nicolas Maduro, Daniel Ortega, Evo Morales, the Cuban leadership, Miguel Díaz-Canel now and before him, Fidel and Raúl Castro, they've all been extremely strong defenders of these fundamental principles in international law and international relations. They're enshrined very clearly in the United Nations Charter of 1948, Declaration of Human Rights, and so on.
Of non-interference and self-determination. Right.
Yeah, self-determination of peoples, non-intervention in other countries' affairs, and non-aggression.
Right.
And, of course, all those principles have been completely, regularly, permanently abused by the United States
and its allies
ever since the UN was founded.
Yeah, U.S. foreign policy is aggression, intervention, and whatever the other one was. Yeah,
and the non-recognition of sovereignty.
Right, exactly.
And I love that phrase that you use when we're talking about Western intervention in general, but corporate intervention and in particular, give us your stuff or else.
That's basically it.
and that has been United States policy forever, really.
Yep.
And for us here in Nicaragua, and that's very relevant now, and that whole issue of national sovereignty and respect for national sovereignty and the issue of the self-determination of peoples. And we're here in Nicaragua, we're all very much looking forward to Friday the 19th, which will be the 40th anniversary of the Sandinista revolution here in Nicaragua.
By the way,
and it's very interesting the way this year it's taken on a significance that it might not have had in other years. Because the United States and its allies have been so aggressive in the region and so determined in trying to roll back very clear progress in social and economic terms for the impoverished majority across Latin America that was carried out by progressive governments, starting with the government of Venezuela under Comandante Hugo Chavez. Back in, when was it, 1998, 1999, carried forward by Evo Morales in 2006, Rafael Correa shortly after that, obviously the government in Cuba has been maintaining its progressive and radical positions in terms of social and economic progress for as long as anybody can remember, despite the constant aggression from the United States. And then briefly, Honduras was part of ALBA And you had here in Nicaragua, the Sandinista Front, led by President Daniel Ortega, completely transformed the country in a period of about 10 years between 2007 and 2017-2018. And that period came to an abrupt, it kind of suffered a shock, if you like, as a result of the United States' determination to do everything possible to stop the development of these progressive policies. And that took various forms, didn't it? And there was the soft coup in Paraguay against President Lugo. There was the military coup in 2009 in Honduras. There was the parliamentary coup in Brazil that displaced Dilma Rousseff. And then you had a kind of legitimate electoral victory by Mauricio Macri when he comprehensively deceived people in voters in Argentina about what his program was. And as a result of that process, and the fact that Nicaragua has now not only survived and is now in its 40th year with the Frente Sandinista at the very forefront of social and economic development in Nicaragua, but it actually survived an attempted regime change last year in 2018. And it did it extremely successfully. And one of the things that I found very interesting over the last few days is the way even intellectuals who have kind of looked askance, who've not been very supportive of the Sandinista revolution, and people like Atilio Barón, for example, who's a very well-known Argentine political analyst, who's been very supportive of the Cuban Revolution and very supportive of Lula in Brazil and very supportive of all the Alba governments. But he's somebody who has, because of his friendships with ex-Sandinistas, he's one of these people that has never felt able explicitly in the past to say, right, well, a priority must be to support the Sandinista revolution. And he actually said that this week. He posted a video and circulated it. Wow. And so you've got one of these people and there's another guy called Ignacio Ramonet, who's a very well-known figure in Europe and in Latin America, a leading figure. And I think he was the founder of Le Monde Diplomatique, which is a very influential review. And I think it's it comes out monthly. Both in paper and online, of political analysis covering international relations, but in particular Latin America. And he too is somebody who's been relentlessly critical of the Frente Sandinista under the leadership of Daniel Ortega. But recently even he came out in support of the Sandinista government here, faced with the U.S. attempt at regime change last year. So and that seems to me to indicate that even kind of I tend to overuse this term the kind of mealy-mouthed left, the mealy-mouthed progressives will try and cover their back so that whatever constituency that they depend on for their network of support, and that they're able to maintain their relationship with that constituency. And so the general opinion in progressive circles in Western Europe, in North America, and also even in Latin America, although that's changed over the last couple of years, has been that, well, there's something not quite right about the Frente Sandinista, and we can't really support it because they're not really progressive, or they have these neoliberal policies, which is absolute nonsense. And what we found is that over the last couple of years, in particular during the attempt at regime change, these people have been put on the spot because they have to face the question, well, look, are you against U.S. intervention in Latin America or are you not? Right?
I mean, this is the same question, you know, just to interrupt for a moment and punctuate this. This is the same question that, you know, didn't get properly dealt with by members of the left in the National Assembly elections in Venezuela, when people were saying, well, they're not moving fast enough, and they withheld their support and allowed the opposition, the right wing, to get hold of the National Assembly and wreak all kinds of havoc from there. The same thing that put Macri in power in Argentina. The same thing that allowed both Dilma Rousseff to stand on a weak majority when really the people's sentiment is stronger, but there was, you know, left opposition to her also. They're not moving fast enough, and neither did Lula. This is the same nonsense that we hear from a lot of people on the left. While this battle for 600 million people's lives goes on, you know, they're looking at, you know, religious doctrine rather than the material world.
Yeah, and so you have feminist opinion, progressive opinion, and in North America and Western Europe and Latin America criticizing the Nicaraguan government for their position on abortion, because technically it's supposed to be illegal, but in fact, and Nicaragua has dramatically reduced its levels of maternal mortality. Right. Now, how do you square those two positions?
Right.
I just find it very hard to cope with progressives who focus on one particular issue, and they'll say, oh well, I look at this crack in the front of the building. That's not very good, is it?
Right.
And but when you need to say to them, well, look, take a step back and have a look at the whole building. Look at what they're building.
Right.
You know, and do you know what I mean? It's
right.
So when in Nicaragua, Nicaragua is something like it's seventh in the world or something like that. It's in the top 10 in the world for representation of women in politics. The level of activity of women in Nicaragua's economic life is dramatically better than any of its neighbors, and all kinds of health indicators for women are dramatically better than in neighboring countries. But that doesn't seem to count, you know. On that one issue, people will say, "Oh well, we have to condemn the Nicaraguan government, the Sandinista government. They're not really progressive because they don't support abortion." Well, you know, I mean, that's
right.
You have to understand that in Nicaragua, 80% of the population say that they're Christian and either evangelical or.
Or Catholic, Roman Catholic,
and in that culture, and there isn't at the moment the kind of secular opinion that prevails in the United States and Western Europe about issues like abortion.
Right.
So you know, and what are you going to say? Are you going to say, well, we're going to impose our view of things on these people, even though they don't accept it?
Right.
And that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, I mean, because the point of all of this, by the way, look, you know, there are some people who are, you know, actual, genuine activists moving forward, you know, the equal rights of whichever group they're, you know, working on a positive agenda in a way that is also in tandem with the general overall progress of that society. And there are others whose job, basically, they get paid to go find the crack in the building and call a press conference in front of it to have the building end up being knocked down because someone in Langley wants it knocked down. I mean, if you were, I'm going to just use an absurd example. You have a society somewhere where all of the men have to go to work at a job that is entirely productive, non-exploitative, then pays $1 million a year, and all of the women have to stay home and drink cocktails by the poolside every day. And then you have another society where men and women without discrimination all have to go fight in a battlefield somewhere. And you're going to have people coming from that society to educate the people in the other society about equality. That's kind of what goes on around the world right now with U.S. identity politics, not looking at U.S. imperialism as the biggest problem in the world.
Yeah, and if you look at the concrete experience here in Nicaragua, what happened during the failed coup attempt last year? You had leading feminists sitting down with the bourgeois capitalist elite here in Nicaragua.
Right.
You had somebody. There's a woman called Sandra Ramos who was very well known in progressive circles, both in Nicaragua and also overseas, and who led an unemployed women's movement. And she sat down with the opposition, with the top capitalists here in Nicaragua, and on the other side were all the labor organizations.
Right, right, okay.
Right? So,
please.
In that particular case, you had a very clear example of what people will do when push comes to shove.
Right.
And their class alliances, the class alliances of those leading feminists, was with the bourgeois capitalist elite here in Nicaragua. Mm. That was what they did. They allied with those interests against the interests of the impoverished majority.
And what you're showing is that now what's happening actually in Nicaragua is that the various intellectuals and others who were tending that way are starting to come home to say, look, we better defend this or it's going to be gone.
Yeah, and that's happening at a regional, international level rather than just inside Nicaragua, because inside Nicaragua, where people stand has been clear for a very long time.
Right.
But and the fact that people like Atilio Barón and Ignacio Ramonet are now taking assuming the same position as Stella Colony, who's a veteran Argentinian writer who was practically the only major Latin American intellectual who's maintained an anti-imperialist position in an absolutely clear-cut way with no equivocation whatsoever for as long as anybody can remember. She defended Libya. She defended the Jamahiriya, you know? And
right.
So, and she was absolutely clear about that, whereas people like Atilio Barón would not. They talked about the supporting the revolutionary insurrection in Libya, you know, when what that meant was supporting a NATO intervention. So and better late than never is how I feel about Atilio Barón and
right.
people like him.
Right.
That's only one aspect or one symptom of a general acknowledgement in Latin America that's become clearer and clearer over the last two or three years, especially in the Foro Sao Paulo.
Right.
And the Foro Sao Paulo is the regional grouping through of Latin American and Caribbean progressive political movements and political parties. And for a long time, Nicaragua had to kind of, they didn't quite accept Nicaragua as a genuine revolutionary force in the region. But after the events of last year, there's no doubt they just have to.
Right.
Because Nicaragua and Venezuela and Cuba and Bolivia too, but in particular Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua, are the countries in the region who are most under attack and who have been actually identified by Pompeo. Was it Pompeo who talked about...
Yeah, the axis of evil or whatever. The triad, the trinity, the troika, right.
So there you have an absolutely explicit recognition. Why is the United States targeting Nicaragua?
Got to pick this up next week at this point because we're completely out of time. But Tony, thank you so much for your time. As always, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks a million, Don. Let's talk next week.
You got it.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.